This is the Fantasy Focus Books and Authors Podcast, Episode 6. Good day and welcome to this episode of the Fantasy Focus Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, podcaster and author of Fun Fantasy Reads. This podcast is exactly what the title says it is. It's a show focused on everything in fantasy books. Whether it's epic fantasy or urban fantasy, swords and sorcery, or anything else in between, I want you to expect to find the best and brightest authors from all the various corners of the fantasy book world here on the show. Plus, we're going to add in a few other very special guests along the way. First up, I do have an update on what I've been working on. I just got back from a week-long trip to Austin, Texas at the Smarter Artist Summit. It's kind of bittersweet. This is the final one of those particular events, but it was good to see everybody there, and I had a great time. It was awesome hanging out with people I consider my tribe, a couple hundred of them, as a matter of fact. We talked about how to write better stories, talked about great ways to interact with readers like all of you in the audience out there. I also just enjoyed meeting and hanging out with some of those folks that I've made friends with over the years. Now I'm back home. I'm going to be working, digging into my next project. It's book 2 in my Sapiens Run trilogy, Cyber's Escape. It's pretty intense as I'm carrying over the energy that ended book 1 into the beginning of this next book. And so it's been a little bit challenging to get into it and dig into the writing, but I've been enjoying that. I like that challenge. That's why I write. So it's kind of fun. Incidentally, book 1, Cyber's Change, comes out this coming April. It's already available for pre-order. So if you're interested in picking that up or getting it, you can get it, the ebook version of it, for 99 cents on pre-order only. So just want to check that out. So that's it for me. I did just get my new Emergency Medical Services series books 4 through 6 audiobook approved. So that should be showing up wherever you get audiobooks out there. And that includes your local library. I don't know if a lot of people knew this, but you can actually listen to a bunch of audiobooks for free at your local library. And all of my books that are in audio are also available through the various audiobook apps that the libraries use out there. So if you're looking for one of my books and you don't want to spend, you know, $15 or $20 or a credit or whatever for it, you can head over to your library and request the librarian to pick it up and add it to their account, or they may already have added it, because I know a lot of people are checking out my books through the various library portals. So that's kind of fun. As always, if you need more information on me, you can always head over and check out my fan group, Jamie's Fun Fantasy Superfans, over on Facebook or on my website and blog, jamiedavisbooks.com. And I always look forward to hearing from you, so please reach out to me. Okay, enough about that. Let's get into the show. So we've got a very special guest in this episode. We have Anna Smith Spark coming on the show. She's a critically acclaimed Gemmel and BSF Award shortlisted author with the Empires of Dust Grimdark epic fantasy series, and that includes The Court of Broken Knives, The Tower of Living and Dying, and The House of Sacrifice. And I'm really excited to have Anna on the show. She's multi-talented, and I got to talking with her about some of the things. She has a host of previous jobs, including being an English teacher, a petty bureaucrat, and she said even a fetish model. So if you run into her at a con, she said you'll know she's coming when you hear the heels of her shoes clicking on the floor, which kind of sounds kind of creepy, doesn't it? So I guess that's what she's going for, though, as she calls herself the Queen of Grimdark. So we'll check that out. Let's go ahead and get into that awesome interview with Anna Smith Spark. Anna, I want to welcome you to the Fantasy Focus Podcast. It's great to have you on the show with us today.
Hi, it's fantastic to be here. Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, no problem. So why don't we start off by giving you an opportunity to introduce yourself to our audience and tell them a little bit about yourself and your background.
Okay. So, yeah, my name's Anna Smith Spark. I'm a epic grimdark fantasy novelist from London, England. I am the author of The Court of Broken Knives, which was Gemmel and British Fantasy Society shortlisted. The Tower of Living and Dying, which there's a campaign to try and get it Hugo nominated, which is pretty awesome. And The House of Sacrifice, which will be out next summer. Sorry, this summer. We're, you know, in the next year. Yeah, no, I write kind of lyrical, poetic, mythological, deeply scatological, and deeply, extremely violent, grimdark fantasy. What else to say about myself? I wear extreme shoes. If people may know me from cons as the woman with the shoes without any heels. And not, it's apropos of nothing, but I am Asperger's syndrome, dyslexic and dyspraxic, which means I was actually the last person in my class at junior at school to learn to read and write. And I still can't spell, and I still have some problems reading things sometimes.
And yet you write really awesome books. And I have to say, I just started the first book in the series, and it is really interesting. I like the way you describe your writing style as lyrical, because it really is almost, you know, lyrical and poetic in the way your prose is structured. And I really like that. It caught me a little off guard at the beginning, but in a good way. And I started really getting into the way you were describing what was going on. It was this series of sensations and things. And I think people that have read your books will understand that. And for those that haven't, I think they'll really get into it.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I mean, yeah, the way I write, I know, is fairly unusual. Actually, I mean, my background is actually, I guess, in poetry. I've never written much poetry. I wrote teenage, awful kind of, I hate myself and I want to die poetry when I was a teenager, just sitting in a room in the dark by candlelight. But my dad is a very serious figure in a very sort of small world of kind of avant-garde poetics. His website is cached by UCLA and Berkeley. I've grown up with poetry as much as with prose. And yeah, no, it does. When I started writing Broken Knives, I didn't intend it to be a fancy novel. I started writing a poetic description of something I could see in front of me, which turned out to be a fancy novel. So yeah, no, the poetic language and the style and the trying to convey sensation and experience and feeling and the kind of the viscerality of what I'm writing about, that's really what I want to do with my writing. That's really what interests me.
So, and you describe your writing as violent, and I would agree. I think it is, but maybe that's because you're writing grimdark. And so why don't you describe for me what you think grimdark fantasy is? How would you define it?
My Twitter handle is Queen of Grimdark, which I guess kind of sets me up for being kind of, I should be an authority on this. I've engaged in several discussions about this. So yeah, I mean, like, you get this discussion so often, what's the difference between grimdark and dark fantasy and blah, 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 and how do you define this? And I mean, in some ways, actually, to be honest, in some ways, I kind of embrace the label grimdark because there was that thing about women authors being categorized as YA when they're really not YA. So that has actually happened to me. My book has apparently, people have seen The Court of Broken Knives in the YA section of bookshops, which would be just, I don't want to think if someone.
That disturbs me.
I know. Because you see, people see it's by a woman and they see this stuff about, you know, being a young man with a mysterious past, and they kind of assume, well, you know, it must be YA because it's by a woman. And it's got this stuff about a young man with a mysterious past. So partly the grimdark thing is a kind of desperate attempt to warn people. Like, just please don't think this is YA. Please don't think this is YA. I had some real issues on Goodreads, actually, where a whole load of people requested it on NatGalley thinking it was YA. And all the reviews were like, what the hell? What the hell? This isn't YA. What? It's really violent. I didn't intend it to be grimdark. I guess I wasn't that aware at the time when I started writing it. I don't know what that says about me, that what I just started writing and what I wrote was extreme violence. But I mean, I guess actually I've always read things, fantasy, in a slightly, I think, different way to people, where I'm hugely cynical. I work in the British, I've worked for the British government. I am hugely cynical about notions of right and wrong, about notions of good and evil, about anyone who's ever stands up and says they're going to make the world a better place, or, you know, their destiny is to make the world a good place. They are somehow that they are somehow on the side of good and their destiny is to save us. I'm so intensely, incredibly suspicious of. I'm suspicious of leadership, I'm suspicious of power. And I think that's a lot of what Grimdark is about, is that kind of interrogation of any of the kind of heroic notions of good and evil that are so central to fantasy. So I've been compared to R. Scott Baker several times. In fact, someone kind of said to me, you know, we're doing quite similar stuff, and we are. We're both absolutely interrogating the notion of the hero. And, you know, the kind of the hero, the promised one, the one who will save us from this kind of terrible, cataclysmic evil, the dark lord, the darkness, the kind of... And we're both absolutely interrogating that and trying to kind of address what that means and what kind of lead it, what following someone who promises, you know, they have a kind of savior figure might actually mean. And that for me is that kind of cynicism about the hero and about the idea of it, things being as of good and evil, is absolutely central. I mean, again, people sort of point to the kind of the Robb Stark figure, that kind of, you know, the young man, he's clean cut, he's on the side of good, he's acting to defend his family's honour, and then of course it all just goes horribly wrong, because actually reality usually is good things go horribly wrong and good intentions lead to bad intentions. And that for me, I think, is absolutely central to Grimdark. It's not just about violence, although Grimdark novels are, I think, an intrinsic part of them is that they are extremely violent, but it's also about an interrogation of violence and about any kind of simplistic categories of good and evil and right and wrong, and any kind of simplistic sense of I know this person, they are good and I trust them, and I will know that kind of any kind of simplistic morality is interrogated. That's hugely interrogated by Grimdark, I think.
I think so too. And one of the things that I've always looked for in those situations is not only is the hero interrogated by the way the book is written, but the villain is too, because they often come off as sympathetic at times, because you start to understand that nothing's black and white, that everyone has their motivation that in their eyes is good.
I mean, that kind of, you know, the great political danger is always the presentation of someone as evil. As soon as we've seen so many times, as soon as you start presenting a person or a group of people as evil and start simply saying, well, you know, something they do is bad, something they do is wrong, they are just intrinsically bad people. Just, you know, that's when the worst moments of human history have always happened. That kind of, that as soon as you start demonizing someone and just saying they are irredeemably evil, you know, that is the moment when absolutely the worst point, worst, everything that's but worst about humanity comes out. And it is very easy for us to always think, well, I'd know. Obviously, when people, you know, when we're saying someone is bad and they, you know, when we're demonizing someone who is a tyrant torturing his people and stealing their money, and, you know, there are children starving in hospital without medicine while he is sitting in his gold-plated bath, it's very easy to say, well, I know that that person is evil, and obviously that is an evil thing. Whereas when you have Nazism saying, you know, there's the appalling anti-Semitic things, you know, saying, you know, the Jewish people are evil, somehow you can see the difference. Somehow it's very obvious that you know, it's the idea that telling that someone, you know, obviously in that situation, the person saying these other people are evil is in fact the evil one. It seems so obvious from us to be able to say, with hindsight, to be able to say, well, obviously I'd know, obviously. But again and again, it's been shown that we don't. As soon as you start demonizing anyone, as soon as you start saying this person is the Dark Lord and these people are his orcish armies and all they're going to do is overwhelm the earth and kill everyone, therefore we must fight them and we must destroy them, that's where... And we will not, you know, we were not trying to think about any possibility of what's going on here or their perspective. That's always where disasters arise from. So it's, you know, it really is important to think about, to try and have a more subtle presentation, nuanced presentation of actually of evil and of what people are doing. I don't, I don't deny that evil exists. I think evil, you know, in fact, at the moment I'm moved fairly close to denying that good exists, saying fundamentally everything is evil, it's good that I severely doubt the existence of. But one always needs to question, you know, why is someone doing this? What is going on here? I must see this person, I must see someone as human, I must try and understand them as a human being, because otherwise just it kind of inhuman acts result. So actually, I mean, I think Grimdark is incredibly politically powerful and actually incredibly, in a way, a narrative of hope. People get so dismissive, people sort of are shocked that as a woman I cheerfully use this term, because there is that, oh, isn't that just horrible books about, you know, rape and murder and horrible people being horrible? I said, well, yes, it is. It is about nihilism. It is that there is a lot of stuff about sexual violence. There is a lot of stuff about just deep unpleasantness. But in the end, it's kind of saying, in a way, you know, we're all deeply flawed, deeply unpleasant, deeply troubled people. We all do horrible things to each other. The world is a really horrible place. But we've got to carry on. We've got to kind of carry on trying to live our lives and actually trying to think about what it is we're doing and ask questions about what it is we're doing and, you know, really think about things, think about the way we engage with the world, think politically, think about the way we engage with the world. So I think actually Grimdark is profoundly important politically and in terms of kind of social commentary, and actually in a kind of weird way kind of suggesting there's some kind of hope, because if you start thinking about things and the way the world operates, actually thinking about the way we all live within the world and the way we interact with each other, then maybe we can become better people.
I like that. You mentioned earlier that you did a lot of reading that kind of led you in this direction. I'm curious what it was you read as you grew up and as you started thinking about writing that spurred you to think this was what you wanted to write.
So I was brought up reading fantasy and reading mythology and reading history. Some of my earliest memories, actually, I have a really, really early memory of having a children's book about ancient history and sitting. I can still really, really clearly see these illustrations of ancient Sumer and ancient Akkad and Çatalhöyük and Jericho, the sort of weird things like the bull cult in Çatalhöyük, I remember this image of these strange eagle priests burying, sort of giving offerings to this kind of image of a bull that they think was the kind of ritual practice in a temple in Çatalhöyük in Turkey. I have this really strong memory of the skulls in Jericho. So in ancient Jericho, once people had died, their skulls were kind of, their skulls were defleshed, and then these kind of weird plaster masks were put over the skulls and carry shells were put in the eyes. So you get these really strange kind of mask-like faces attached to the skulls of the dead, which seems to have had these kind of cult importance. And I remember I read a lot of mythology. A book that I think my dad read me and then I read later was Kevin Crossley Holland's Axe Age Wolf Age, which is his telling of the Norse myths from the creation of the world, Ymir the Giant, to Ragnarok. And he just writes it absolutely astonishingly, and he had these wonderful little woodcut illustrations, and he writes, it's incredibly raw and violent, and again it's not the gods are the goodies, the giants are the baddies. It's got that very kind of Norse death cult. The gods are violent and unpleasant. This is not a kind of moral religious world. This is a religious world that's focused around the fact this is a very violent culture and a very violent, inhospitable environment to be in. And I just remember these things just absolutely soaking into me, just really kind of, just these weird haunting images. And these, I've just been obsessed with mythology and history, ancient history, my whole life. So it just, when I sat down to write, what I was writing was kind of basically mythological ancient history fan fiction, all fantasy is just us writing kind of fan fiction. Tolkien was writing fan fiction based on Norse mythology. We're writing, it's almost like, you know, we've read all the histories, we've read all the mythologies, so hey, let's the only thing we can do now is write our own to kind of make more of them.
Oh, I like that. Your book, The Court of Broken Knives, is you said, is a kind of a coming of age story of sorts with Meredith as the central character. And I'm curious, because when I get an idea for a story, one of the first things I do is start thinking about the character and building out from there. So I really define the character first and try to figure out their motivations and how they fit into the overarching story idea, and then build the story outward from there. I'm curious how you go about that process. How did Meredith come about?
I have no idea. Well, actually, I think Meredith and Thalia have always been with me. I think, looking back, I used to tell myself stories all the time. I'd always tell myself stories based on mythology and high fantasy and fairy tales. And I think Meredith and Thalia were always in my mind. I suspect that every sort of, when I was 10 years old, you know, the sort of stories I was telling myself that were basically children's high fantasy stories, the prince was always Meredith, and the princess was always Thalia. I think Meredith is actually a huge part of my psyche. Meredith and all the characters, I mean, they are, when you're writing, you are essentially writing the contents of your own mind. And Meredith and Thalia are very much a central element of, I think, of my mind. I think Meredith is probably a lot of the kind of deeply repressed, unpleasant parts of my mind, kind of channeled and made real. I didn't really have any sense of him when I started writing the novel. Again, I didn't have any sense of plot, I didn't have any sense of world, I didn't plan any of it. I just started writing, and this world was just evolving, and I was discovering this world as I wrote, and the characters were evolving as well, and I was discovering them, and I was meeting them. So as Meredith's kind of identity and his coming of age is revealed, that was being revealed to me as I was writing it. I didn't know all these things about him when I began writing him. And I was getting to know him as I'm writing and exploring him and discovering him. I mean, he is obviously, you know, there's a lot of Alexander the Great in him. There's a lot of Achilles in him. There's a lot of Cuchulain in him. Again, these are, you know, these are the great mythical stories that I've read and reread and reread and reread. I studied the Iliad and the campaigns of Alexander at university. It was I did classics at university. I have stumbled painfully over attempting to translate the amazing section of the Iliad where Achilles appears in his new armor on the plain of Troy, shining like the sun, just as a force of destruction to destroy the Trojans, to avenge the death of Patroclus, to kill Hector. I have struggled over attempting to translate that from the original Greek into English in an exam, which was, given that's one of my favourite passages in all literature, it was also one of the most traumatic experiences I've ever had, and it was horrible. It was the worst exam I've ever done. But yes, I mean, all those images are so rooted in my mind. They're absolutely, I have read so many biographies of Alexander the Great. I've read so many novelizations of the life of Alexander. I've read so many books about the Iliad. I've read, you know, it's all just there, and it was just coming out as I wrote. You could do an analysis of that book as kind of everything that obsesses me and haunts me and has ever interested me in my life, I think, probably. Which is, people get really freaked out when I say Meredith is me, but kind of, he's the kind of repressed, he's my animus, he's the kind of repressed part of me in Jungian terms.
No, I think you're absolutely right. We do write from within ourselves, and even though I do plan my characters out or try to, one of the biggest joys of writing for me is when my characters surprise me. And
yeah, no, it's wonderful. It's just such a wonderful feeling.
Yeah, I completely agree. And it's joyful. I mean, I laugh sometimes out loud while I'm writing, because it just is so much fun to have that happen where you thought it was going one way and they go, no, I looked over here and saw something shiny and I'm going over there because that's more important right now. And just, it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah. No, I mean, it really does, that moment when they're absolutely just alive in you and you realize that these characters Yeah, they're not words on a page anymore. They're absolutely just, they are living in your mind now, and they're absolutely. So actually, the big thing for me was in The Court of Broken Knives when I was writing the character of Orhan. So I didn't intend at all, spoiler alert, although this is in the first third of the book, so I think I'm allowed to talk about that. I didn't intend at all that he would be in a relationship with Darth Vorley. And I was writing the scene, and this tension was just building, the sexual tension between the two of them. And I just wrote these words that he turned to his ex-lover. And it was just suddenly, it was like, oh my God, I didn't know that about you, Orhan. And that's, thank you for telling me that. And now suddenly, you know, everything about you makes sense now you've explained that to me, because things that, in his story, that was slightly like, I know I need to put this in, I'm not quite sure why. And now that I've realised you were in a relationship with this other character, suddenly everything just makes sense about you. And thank you for telling me that now, rather than, you know, a week after the book had been published. Because kind of, and it does feel like they've just become, they have, much as though you feel like, okay, this character is, on the one hand, you're like, this is me, this is my heart, this is my heart and soul, this is a part of me. And this is, you know, this is me working something out about myself. This is me exploring myself. On the other hand, your part of you is like, you're like, there is like children. It's like looking at them and like, my God, you know, this thing is alive and it's different for me and it's absolutely alive now. And it's just amazing watching it and seeing this character go and just seeing them explore and sort of like, you know, seeing another life, kind of living their life as you're writing them and beginning to understand them. And it's amazing.
So you said you kind of just started writing with The Court of Broken Knives and kept going and discovering as you went. Is that what your writing process is always like for like the second book and as you're working on the third book now?
Yes. Well, so the second and third books, obviously, by the time I came to write them, I'd had to do the whole classic. You know, you have your agent gives you half an hour to knock up a synopsis for books two and three that they'll take to the publisher because, you know, they're trying to sell the trilogy, not just the one book. And I always knew that when I finished Broken Knives, it was really, you know, it finished where it finished, but obviously it was going to go on. And I'm a huge fan of the kind of basically the novel in three parts, like The Lord of the Rings, like The Prince of Nothing, where, you know, you really wouldn't want to pick up book two on its own because you need to have read book one and then you need to read book three. It's like picking up a book, an individual volume of a book halfway through and then wondering why you don't understand what's going on and then finishing it after two chapters and wondering why you don't know what happened at the end. So I always knew it was going to be a big three books as one book kind of series, but I had to kind of really hurriedly make up this synopsis for books two and three to go to the publishers. So then when I was writing them, obviously I had this vague synopsis. I mean, we all know you don't really stick to the synopsis, but at the same time, you kind of have to a bit because your publishers are expecting that this story will now go in a certain way. And of course, by then, you know, I had the storyline, I knew where it was going to go. Having discovered all this about the characters, I knew very clearly where the story was going to go and where, how it ended. And I'd written the end quite early on. I've had the ending of book three written for, I think, well, actually, since I finished book one, I've already had, once I finished Court of Broken Knives, I knew exactly how it ended and I had that ending written. So it was more, it was that, actually, Peter Newman, the author of The Vagrant, has this lovely thing about when you're writing later book, how for him it's kind of, you're standing on a mountaintop and there's a great valley of mist and then there's another mountaintop and you know you need to get to that further mountaintop, but you have no idea how you're going to get there because all there is between the two is this kind of mist-covered valley. So you have to go down into the mist and find your way somehow to the top of the next mountain that you know is there. And that was more like that for books two and three, where I knew where I was going, but I didn't really know how I was going to get there. Short stories are fun because they are just, when I'm writing short stories, I have no idea what I'm doing. I have no idea who these people are. I have no idea what's going on here. I'm set somewhere in my world, but let's just see what happens. And that's quite fun because that's just kind of, those are back to just exploring and whittling around, just with no idea what's happening and no idea where I am and no idea who these people are. And somehow it all just unfolds and I discover it. I mean, the joy and excitement of discovering this thing, having it just unroll before you, like going travelling or something. I mean, for me, it's like, if you imagine being sort of someone treating you some kind of amazing birthday surprise where they put you on a plane blindfold and, you know, you land at an airport, you know where you are, and you're in this amazing, you know, you've flown half across the world and you don't know where you are and you're just in this amazing new city exploring it and discovering it and trying to work, make any sense of it. It's just so exciting. It's amazing experience.
When you do get out to meet the fans, what's your favorite way to do that? Do you prefer to meet them in an online setting via social media or things like that? Or do you like to meet them in person, like at a con or someplace like that?
Oh, both. So, I go to cons quite a lot. I'm coming over to the States twice this year, actually. I've been invited to be a guest at Gen Con, the big gaming convention in Indianapolis. So I'm going over to that, and I'm really looking forward to meeting people there, and I love meeting people. I'm going to Worldcon in Dublin, and I'm also actually going to go over to the World Fantasy Convention in Los Angeles, which sounds terribly glamorous, except it's in Los Angeles Airport, so actually I just get to see Los Angeles Airport. But and I love meeting people. I love chatting to people and just hanging out with people and doing BarCon and talking to people after panels. It's just fantastic. If you see people see me at a con, just come up and talk to me, please. Always come up and talk to me. I love talking to people. But similarly, also, I love social media. I spend a lot of time on Facebook and Twitter. I'm kind of trying to cut back a bit actually on Facebook and Twitter because they do get slightly, I need to write a book. I can't be engaging with people too much because I'm actually supposed to be writing this damn book. But I love talking to people on social media. Because I like writing, so communicating with people by the form of writing is fantastic. I could do it all the time. I just love talking to people about books and things because I grew up in a small town, just a small, really rubbish community town. There were not that many other teenagers, particularly teenage girls, who were really massively into violent fantasy and war stories and ancient history and mythology. And who wanted to spend all their time watching extremely violent combat films and playing D&D and listening to extreme metal. I was reduced to the point I'd go to the library and get out books. I remember getting out the Sandman comic books from the library, if anyone remember those, Neil Gaiman's Sandman. And I was borrowing them, and then I'd notice sometimes someone else was borrowing them. And I nearly actually wrote a little note saying, who are you? You're the one other person in Bishop Stortford who really seems to appreciate really good graphic novels. Like, can we meet for coffee? Because, of course, that back in the day when I were a lass, that was the only, there wasn't social media. And now meeting people all over the world who, as soon as you mention a particular book, they're just like, oh, yeah, God, I love that book. Oh, that scene, oh God, that's such an amazing scene. Oh, I love that author, that prose is so amazing. And you just find yourself at a con or on Facebook having this massive, fantastic conversation about as an obscure book that you both love, or having a massive argument about gender politics in series 5 of Game of Thrones or something. It is the happiest time of my life. So yeah, there is no bad way of meeting fans because it's just so amazingly exciting still for me to meet people who actually like the same books as me and want to talk about the same stuff as me and just completely nerd out about it.
Yeah, it's there's nothing quite like seeing somebody face to face that, come over and say, "Ah, I read your book," and just it. We write and we put it out there, right? And it's you wonder, is anyone actually reading it? There's sales going on, but. Is it just sitting on a shelf somewhere?
I had an amazing experience at Worldcon last year in San Jose. It was the first time I'd ever been in America. And it was my first morning there. I was massively jet lagged. Obviously, I didn't really know anyone. I'd just gone over there on my own. And I was just sitting, just went to sit down at a big, there was a big kind of communal table by a coffee bar, and I just sort of said to someone, "Oh, do you mind if I sit here?" And they were having a conversation about book covers. So this bit being the kind of place where obviously people do talk to each other, I sort of joined in talking to them because I love talking about book covers. It's a cool thing to talk about. They were talking about the difference between American and English book covers, and there are always differences between American and English book covers, so I joined in the conversation. And then one of them just turned to me and said really casually, your book covers, Anna, are an interesting example. And he was like, I am. What both my US and my UK covers look like. I was just like, oh my God, I love you so much for saying that. This is just incredible, you know, the fact you've read my book. I'm just sitting here and we're having a conversation. Now it turns out you've read my book. I mean, just how unbelievably, amazingly awesome is that? Can I buy you a coffee and give you a hug and just tell you that you're just awesome? I mean, it's just such an incredible thing when someone tags me into a review of my book and they like my book. It's just, you know, it's just like, my God, just wow, just thank you so much. Meeting people who like my book is good.
I you know, you did a great job of representing about how I feel in the same situation. So you just kind of are, it's just a very special moment for me, and it sounds like for you as well. So that's great. We're going to kind of wrap up here. So is there a place you want folks to look for your website that they can go and find out what's going on with you and things like that?
Yeah, so I have a website which is www.courtofbrokenknives.org, although I don't update it a huge amount. It's got some wonderful, wonderful fan art, actually. I've been hugely lucky in, first of all, getting my wonderful map illustrator, who's also done some pictures for me. And then I've had some unbelievably beautiful fan art done for me by various people, which is up on my website. And some stuff. There's a couple of, for some reason, every year I decide to write a New Year story. So there's a couple of weird little vignettes about New Year festivals up on my website. And the web, it's not updated hugely often, but it's very nice. I think it's quite nice to look at. And I'm on Twitter as @QueenOfGrimdark, and I'm on Facebook and Instagram as Anna Smith Spark. So please follow me, friend me, discuss, talk to me. I'm on Goodreads as well as Anna Smith Spark, although I don't go on Goodreads that often. I have 6 months worth of books I need to dump on it in one go as a bunch of load of reviews. But just always, and I'm occasionally on Reddit as well, actually, as Anna Smith Spark, Reddit Fancy. But just please just always reach out to me, friend me, contact me. If you see me at all the events I'm going to this summer, just come up to me, talk to me, tell me I'm completely wrong about something, tell me that I'm totally wrong about my political theory of Grimdark or something, and let's have a coffee and a massive argument about it. Always come and talk to me.
Fantastic. Well, Anna, thanks for coming on the show. We've got our Quarter Broken Knives, The Tower of Living and Dying, and coming out this summer, The House of Sacrifice in summer 2019. And we'll have links to those first two books in the show notes for this episode so people can find it. And Anna, thanks so much for taking the time to come on and talk to the listeners here at Fantasy Focus Podcast.
Well, thank you again so much for having me. It's been really great. Thank you. Thanks.
That will wrap up this episode of the Fantasy Focus Books and Authors Podcast. I want to make sure you catch up with us online for a whole lot more Fantasy Focus community. You can find that community over on Facebook. Just search for Fantasy Focus. And we just have a lot of things going on over there. There's reviews of books from a great team of reviewers and a lot more. So check it out. Also, you can find out more over at fantasy-focus.com. Leave a comment on this episode and let me know what's on your mind. Also on the website, on each podcast episode post, you'll find links to subscribe to the show on your favorite mobile app for iOS, Android, and apps like Stitcher and TuneIn, or even by email. So make sure you head over and subscribe, and that way you won't miss any of the episodes. We have some pretty awesome authors already scheduled in the next few months, including an upcoming interview with Robin Hobb, which I'm really excited about. I've read Robin's books for a while, and I was just excited to get a chance to chat with her about writing and about meeting readers and all sorts of cool stuff. So that's coming up in the next episode. That's it for this episode, though, here at the Fantasy Focus Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Jamie Davis, author of Fun Fantasy Reads. Don't forget to follow me over on Facebook at Jamie Davis Books and at my website, jamiedavisbooks.com, where you can get a free book if you sign up for my newsletter over there. Whatever you do, though, make sure you subscribe and come back here for the next Fantasy Focus Podcast. In the meantime, I'd like to remind you to remember to keep your eyes open, because there's magic all around you.